Good evening, dear listeners. This is Wissam Sharafuddin speaking to you. This podcast of the Arab American Identity with our guest, Dr. Hani Bawardi, is broadcasting at his third episode, thanks to you and all the support. This podcast can be listened to on dearbornblog.com and other websites also that are sharing this podcast. It can also be found at Muslimish Freethinkers podcast and other podcasts who are sharing this important series. Dr. Bawardi, welcome again.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And thank you for your continuous support and continuation of this important series. We are continuing on the same subject about the Arab identity, and we have reached from last episode to the point of the Ottoman reforms and their influence on the Arab identity. Let's start with that, talking to us about the Ottoman Tanzimat reforms and their influence on the Arab identity.
Sure. Thank you, Sam. Good to be here again. Hello, everyone. We're not going to get into like a dry history. We'll make this as interesting as we'll keep it interesting. Let's say that. So, what happened is that, you know, since the age of explorations, you know, when the Europeans made their way to the New World, of course, it was hardly a discovery. A lot of people have been there already. But those guys managed to siphon a lot of silver and gold and a lot of wealth, sugar and tobacco and pelt, and which made them very, very rich. That coincided with the what is called mercantilism, which is the grandfather of capitalism. So the idea here is that Europe was gaining prominence and power, while the Ottoman Empire was declining, because what happened is, you know, Vasco da Gama also found his way around the Horn of Africa to the Far East, and Europeans began to put their hands on spice, which is very, very valuable commodity. That's how you preserve food through the, you know, summer and the winter. So they bypassed the Ottoman Empire, and they began to gain on the Ottoman Empire. The British took over from the Dutch and the Spanish as the preeminent power on the high seas. They were at odds with the French, but their interests began to coincide. They reconciled their interests in the 19th century, by the beginning of the 19th century, and they began to set their sights on the holdings of the Ottoman Empire. And they pressured the Ottoman Empire to, under the guise of modernizing its system of governance and economics, they made them sign a lot of what is called capitulations, which are economic treaties, which are really lopsided towards the British and the French. So the British destroyed, you know, the navy of Muhammad Ali, who was the governor of Egypt, who became very powerful. Could have been a regional power if he was not under the authority of the Sultan, who was very weak and corrupt for the most part. So the British checked his power. And that sort of doomed the Arabic-speaking regions of the Ottoman Empire, made them vulnerable to Western domination later on. In the meantime, a lot of those Arabs became educated in Western, you know, institutions like Sorbonne, like Rifa'a Rafiq Tahtawi, went to France. 1801, he was actually one of the officers who saw, you know, the French force off out of Egypt. But this French encroachment in 1789, I believe, marked the late modern period, meaning Europe found a way to get at the Ottoman provinces. So, and Arabs were, some of them were Anglophones or Francophones, because they wanted to modernize. But the Ottoman Empire had to modernize in a hasty way that benefited the French and the British. Accordingly, a part of those capitulations or tanzimat, they had tax laws, for example, They did not pay attention to education, but they created a, under French pressure, they created a foothold for the French in the Beirut area by creating the Mutasarrafia of Beirut, which eventually became like a Lebanese republic. So that's one of the most direct effects on Arab identity, is that they awakened in the Arabs a sense of who they are as a people, deserving of sovereignty, deserving of nationhood. Ironically, and actually not so ironic during the period, the American schools and the Franciscan schools played a role in this awakening. They did not teach Arabs anything new, but what they did do is they brought printing presses, exactly what the French did in the Boulak section of Cairo. So you have...
And the Americans to Beirut,
yes,
for basically the purposes of missionaries.
Yes, Eli Smith. Yeah, they wanted to proselytize and turn people into Christians. Mm-hmm. That didn't work because they are already either Christians or monotheists. And you don't convert Muslims into another monotheistic or any other religion because... It just doesn't. It doesn't work that way.
Was that the main reason for bringing the printing press to Beirut?
Initially, absolutely. They, as a matter of fact, Eli Smith worked with Butrus al-Bustani. Butrus al-Bustani is the one who translated, or at least printed, a version of the Bible, Old Testament and the New Testament, in the American presses in Arabic, an American type set. Under their auspices, in one of those American printing presses. So Eli Smith, to be sure, did not do any translations, but Butrus al-Bustani relied on Greek and Hebrew text and more ancient Arabic text that came up with the first modern Bible printed in 1865. So many of the early immigrants who came to the States brought that Bible with them. I happen to have a copy of those, actually. That belonged to a family from Nazareth. So, and then during this period, what the Arabs did also is they began to educate their young at much larger numbers. At one point, there was about 17,000 children in Syria, geographic Syria, that is, in American schools alone, learning grammar, learning science and languages.
Would you say Ibrahim Pasha had a positive influence and had a hand in that, right?
So that's the son of Muhammad Ali of Egypt.
Yes.
That was actually a distinct chapter in the area's history when Muhammad Ali made a move against the Sultan himself. So he sent his son, Ibrahim, who actually reached Konya in the heart of Anatolia. He was marching towards Istanbul.
Oh, wow.
But of course, the British stepped in and helped the Sultan and checked him. However, he himself was Albanian origin, but he learned Arabic, and he basically played a role in that awakening of Arabs that, yes, you can challenge Ottoman authority and Ottoman suzerainty, as it is called, so to get out of this Ottoman yoke. Yeah, so those became even more salient ideas.
And that's a very important example of what, when we talk about Arab identity, because Muhammad Ali Pasha and Ibrahim, who are Albanians, but they're born and raised in Egypt, and they speak Arabic fluently, and they reckon themselves as Arabs.
Yeah, he actually, Ibrahim Pasha said that I was colored Arab by Syria, by the Syrian sun, not an exact quote, but something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
So he recognized the fact that there is a distinct Arab social and national narrative there that is coming of age, that is the surest way of challenging Ottoman authority. It will take a while for that.
Do we consider them Arab?
Well,
In the Arabic psyche, or is Muhammad Ali Pasha Arabic? Because I've always had that feeling that he's not.
You see, earlier we talked about how Islam subsumed Arabism. This is an excellent example how during the Buyid period, actually during the Abbasid period, in fact, a lot of the sultans or the royalties of in Baghdad married fair women from Eastern Europe. And actually during this influx into those areas, which continued during Ottoman rule, the boys, after battle, were conscripted into the army. And the Mamluks are a byproduct of that, which literally means the owned ones. However, in Western discourse, they keep talking about slave this and slave that, that they are slaves. And the truth of the matter is, those were the future leadership of the Muslim...
Prince and princesses.
Absolutely. They became the rulers.
Yes.
Mamluks ruled Egypt, mm-hmm. In fact. And the same thing in Baghdad. So a lot of those children, including Muhammad Ali and his sons, adopted Arab cultural identity. But they have Albanian origins. And what facilitated that is Islam. Because Islam has a capacity for absorption, something that's really important to keep in mind. So Islam is pretty sophisticated. It can adopt that. It can allow that to happen.
Yes.
Under the guise of Islam, they became Arabs. I think is not a very far-fetched way of putting this.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened here in Syria is that those American printing presses and the Franciscan printed presses, this is really critical information, critical development, that is. They began to resurrect and print the Arabic classics, which were preserved either on old copies, ancient text, or orally. Mm. And they were put down in books. For example, you can find a book in a place I actually researched. It is an Orthodox cultural center in rural Pennsylvania, called the Antiochian Village. I found a huge collection of those books that were printed in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, including one book, for example, which is a collection of letters between Al-Hashimi and Al-Kindi. Al-Kindi is a Christian, late antiquity Arab or early Islamic period Arab, and Al-Hashimi is, of course, from the family of the Prophet, or at least hails to Western Saudi Arabia. And Al-Hashimi tells Al-Kindi in so many words that, I like you, you're a good guy, you should become a Muslim, because it's a good fate that awaits good people like yourself. And the Kindi would answer back and say, thank you very much, I value your friendship immensely, but I think maybe you should give Christianity a chance. And that, so those letters were put in a very, very sophisticated kind of endearing friendship, like enduring friendship between the two, was gathered in a book. That was printed in one of those printing presses by, I forget if it was the American printing press or Franciscan, but the Americans then played a role in resurrecting ancient Arab past.
Unintentionally.
And sometimes intentionally. For example, the Bliss family. I mean, the Americans founded what used to be called the American Syrian College. That became AUB,
mm-hmm.
the American University of Beirut, one of the premier learning centers in the Arab world, in the East in general, as a matter of fact. So missionary work gave way to all kinds of activities, and the Americans themselves became smitten with Arab culture, learned the language, and they began to learn from these treaties and ancient texts.
Do you think there were sincere efforts to really resurrect texts and to spread Arabic education by the mm-hmm. Americans?
Some of them were very sincere. The Bliss mm-hmm. family is a classic example.
Mm-hmm.
And they
What was the intentions? What were the intentions?
The intentions were to basically spread, initially was proselytizing,
mm-hmm.
But that branched into other things like spreading knowledge, mm-hmm. running schools.
Elevating civilization.
If you want to be very generous to them, you can say that those things, and many of them were idealist enough that they deserve this characterization. But overall, they were basically extending American reach in the Middle East. America had no coherent policy towards the Middle East one way or another. In fact, that will not happen until World War II, or after World War II for that matter. They did begin to pay attention to the region in 1909, around that time, but nothing major. So the missionary work and those schools was the best messenger the United States can send to the region. It was benign, and at the outskirts of World War I, when it became clear the Ottomans are on the losing end, and we should talk about, you know, the events leading up to World War I, many Arabs became huge fans of Woodrow Wilson. In fact, many of them named their children Woodrow Wilson. Mm-hmm. Wilson or Woodrow Wilson. Because he promised self-determination for all the nations seeking, you know, independence and self-rule, including Syrians in geographic Syria. So, but of course, those Tanzimat chipped away at Ottoman ability to navigate Western demands. So those economic treaties really weakened the Ottoman Empire immensely.
That's prior to colonization.
Absolutely. You know, the thing is, I mean, just so we're not dismissive of the Ottomans, if it weren't for them, the British and the French would have done to the Middle East what they did in Africa and in the Far East, would have colonized it much, much sooner than they did. That happened only after World War I because of the Ottomans. The Ottomans were a bulwark. So their decline was gradual. It was over some 150 years, at least. But the outcome was the same. During that period, what happened is you have this cultural awakening in Syria. Early Nahda. Nahda is a word that means awakening. Literally, as if you're getting up from a lying down position. That's exactly what was happening to Arab way of thinking. So who are we? We're printing all those books, so we have a history. And then what happened after that is that the language became more accessible, whereas all of those books printed so far, late 19th century, were classical Arabic, really impenetrable for Westerners and some Arabs even nowadays, and because of the state of education, I guess.
I know that Nahda is a big topic in itself, but let's just a couple of minutes on it, because it's a very important chapter in the you know, modern Arab history. What influences you think have initiated the Nahda, or the awakening there? So we have the printing presses that was brought by the British and the French, or the Americans and the French.
Yes.
The French Revolution, would you say, is influential on the Nahda?
Well, to an extent, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, the calls of liberty, fraternity, and equality resonated. So what happened is that many of those early activists began to read critiques of nationalism. 19th century is called also the century of nationalism. That's when nation states popped up in Europe proper. That's, most of those nation states took some kind of final form in the 19th century. And there was part of this was movement, the space was a critique of this nationalism. And many Arab intellectuals studied Renan and Voltaire and developed a human critique of this nationalism. At the same time, they became self-aware more and more based on this common ancient past and ideas of democracy and governance. There's the French Revolution. There's the American Revolution, too. There's a Bill of Rights. You have a constitution. I mean, they were exposed to all those things. They began to say, why can't we have our own country? And that country, and this is actually a critical piece of information if you want to understand what the immigrants fought for over 65 years initially, this country was well defined in their minds, from the Taurus Mountains in the north, which separates modern day Syria and Iraq from Turkey, to the Sinai desert in the southwest and the Arabian desert in the southeast and to the east, and roughly west of the Euphrates in the east, all the way to the Mediterranean. So if you think of this area as a collection of cities that interacted with each other since antiquity, like Beirut, Damascus, Haifa, Yaffa, Jerusalem, Nablus traded heavily with Damascus and with Aleppo, for example, all those collection of cities was very cohesive. People had more or less same memory. In fact, even into the 20th century, there was a paper in Palestine called Southern Syria, Suria al-Janubiya. So Palestinians considered themselves Syrians, Southern Syrians, if you want to be precise. Until the rise of Zionism, they began to define themselves as Palestinians per se. And what gave Palestine, historic Palestine, or the Palestinian narrative its final shape, was colonialism, the French and the British, separating Palestine from Lebanon. Before that, there was really not much difference between someone from Bintij Bail or someone from Safad or Nazareth. They actually speak the same accent, for them, as a matter of fact. They have the same accent. They say Issa instead of Hella, for example.
Yeah, even our city in Lebanon, Tir, Sur, it has a Palestinian accent.
Sure.
To most of its people. Yeah.
So all that came to an end after World War I. But in the interim, this is what they wanted. That geographic area, geographic Syria, or what the Arabs called Bilad al-Sham, when they reached that area in the 7th century, to be their independent, free country. And they began to articulate that. So in the mid-19th century, you have something called the Syrian Scientific Society. By whom you can find actually one of its most influential members, Ibrahim. I'm sorry, I have a mental block. The name will come to me in a second. So you can find Maronites, Orthodox, Muslims, Sunnis, Shiites within those societies. The name is Al-Yazigi. Bayhum and Al-Yazigi and Al-Bustani, all those who are members of this society, which laid the foundation for this cultural awakening, which became increasingly political, namely seeking sovereignty. And towards the end of the 19th century, you have secret societies who were pushed underground by the repressive tactics of Sultan Abdul Hamid, the Ottoman Sultan, who was very harsh on his critics. In fact, there was a constitution in 1876 which promised equality that was suspended a year later and remained so until the rise of the Young Turks and the Triumvirate, which reactivated it in 1908, and it was suspended again in 1909. So Arabs were actually in this fluid situation, hopeful that they will achieve autonomy as Ottoman subjects. They were not, opposed to that, because many of them knew that if the Ottoman Empire collapses, they will be easy prey for the French and the British, which exactly what happened later on.
So they are trying to give birth to their nationalistic identity. But in the middle, in between the two, between the two, between the teeth of a lion, you have the fear of colonialism at their doors, and then also the kind of harsh rule of the Ottomans and the dismissal of their right of self-determination.
Exactly. Only in Western discourse, those Western scholars, many of them, including famous names, there's not much use of mentioning them or enumerating them, they don't subscribe to even the existence of Arab national identity or Arab peoplehood. They look at them as those disparate loyalties here and there who are not self-aware. And they come up with theories that say, you know, structuralist theories, we call them, that say that until colonialism brought institutions, you don't have peoplehood without institutions. And those institutions are Western, and they did not happen until after World War I. This way they give themselves justification for what became known as the Mandate period. So those Arab regions were put under the guardianship of France and Britain. And to make that basically worthwhile, they say that that's what created this national identity. And I could not disagree with that more. Because in the mid-19th century, surely by the latter decades of the 19th century, there was articulate, sophisticated plans within secret societies to create a autonomy as a first step, and then complete independence at some point when the Ottomans are basically clear out.
And thank you for sharing details of these documents and in your book, The Making of Arab Americans from Syrian Nationalism to U.S. Citizenship, Doctor. Can you talk to us about the first Arab conference in Paris in 1913?
Sure. That's a very important conference for Arab nationalists throughout the Arab world, in fact. And as a matter of fact, two people were sent as delegates. One in particular, his name is Najib Diab, who represented the Syrian communities in the United States in that conference. So that first Arab conference in Paris in 1913 happened at a time when most Arabs in the region, especially in Syria, geographic Syria that is, the geographic area we described earlier, understood that the days of the Ottoman Empire are numbered and that the Turks are engaged on a policy of Turkification. So they began to work towards complete independence as part of secret societies, among them Al-Ahd, or the promise or the vow, Al-Arab al-Fatat, or the young Arab, and Al-Lajna
al-Merkaziyya
al-Idariyya, Hizb al-Merkaziyya al-Idariyya al-Uthmani, which is translated roughly to the Decentralized Ottoman Administrative Committee, or party. So outwardly, they said, we just want autonomy, but secretly, they wanted complete independence. Based on my documents, I can argue this, and I am alone arguing this. The subject is not enjoying any attention by Western scholars, let alone in Arab-American studies. As a matter of fact, it's a complete void in Arab-American studies. But this is the foundation of our national identity on both sides of the water. So it was important that, for example, Al-Asali or those Arab parliamentarians who are split from the Ottomans and began to engage in the secret activities, Zahrawi, for example, all of those were killed by the Turks, by the way. Shukri al-Asali was killed by the Turks. They began to articulate, you know, future plans for complete independence within those secret societies. And the immigrants agreed with them, copied their activities into secret societies on this side of the Atlantic, one I describe in the book, named the Free Syria Society. And they gathered in Paris in 1913 to make their case for Arab nationalism, and particularly Arab-Syrian nationalism. So the Syrian nationalist movement predates what later became Pan-Arabism, or you know, Lebanese-ness, or Syrian-ness, or Palestinian identity for that matter.
Right. ending this episode with one question, and we'll start the next episode, Doctor, with the Paris conference. I think we need to talk a little bit more about it. I have a few more questions about it. We'll start with it, which is 1913, and we'll dwell into World War I, if you don't mind. The question, the final question I want to ask you in today's episode is, when this national identity started to develop, which is like you described from El Furat to the sea, and you know, including basically the Syria, Jordan, Palestine, and
Lebanon
of today, a part of Iraq, I guess. Why was that one national identity? How did that come about, the feeling that this is one cohesive identity? Why not, you know, from including all of Iraq and Egypt and maybe some parts of North Africa that are that speak Arabic in majority? Why not including Al-Hijaz, where, you know, Sharif Hussein and Arab tribes, they were still in control?
Well, Arab identity as a whole, from the Gulf all the way to Morocco, was on people's minds. However, the need was pressing where Syria is because of the external pressures which added cohesion to this movement, namely Ottoman capitulations and those, you know, French and British designs for the region. So those external pressures sort of helped shape how that movement or that mindset or those political objectives are, or how they came about. So the pressures on Syria were different than the pressures that the Egyptians faced. In Egypt, the British were there since 1882. Egypt was under occupation since that date. And what does that mean? It means that the people who were opposed to Abdul Hamid, including members of the Sarkis family and many other Syrian families, ran away to Cairo. In fact, Al-Ahram, which is the preeminent Egyptian newspaper daily, was founded by those Syrians. So that is a complex situation where some people became misunderstood as Anglophones only because they could say things in Egypt that they could not say in Syria. And they said, okay, well, the British, at least we can oppose Abdul Hamid and they will shield us from Abdul Hamid. Whereas in Egypt, people began to understand that the Egyptians themselves, since the Arabi revolt and even afterwards, were not really that fond of the British. They wanted to get rid of them. So even it will take some time before pan-Arab demands converge. For the time being, the pressures faced by the Syrians were different set of circumstances than what you have in Egypt.
So it was for logistical reasons, not for intellectual ones.
Well, the intellectual articulation of their demands is a byproduct of their political reality, for the most part. They were not at odds. They did not give up Egypt. Egypt did not give up the rest of the Arab world. What happened is that they were reacting to entirely different situations. That's mm-hmm. the only reason why the Syrian nationalist movement had a separate, different trajectory than the Egyptian nationalist movement. However, don't forget, I mean, let's not forget that between 1958 and 1962, you had the United Arab Republic,
right,
comprised of Syria and Egypt as one country.
Yes.
It didn't last very long, but that tells you that, you know, pan-Arabism was on its way, but there was too much intervening, keeping that from happening as of yet.
Right. So it was for, basically, it was being practical with their circumstances.
Yes, you could say so, yeah. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dr. Ribordi, for another episode of Arab American Identity. And we will continue starting with World War One and the first Arabic conference in Paris. Thank you, dear listeners. And if you have any questions or you'd like us to focus on any area of the dialogue, please leave your comments anywhere on Dearborn blog where this podcast is published. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Boyd.
Thank you, Sam Sharafuddin. My pleasure.